and welcome to this FT Advisor in Focus CPD podcast about the future of sustainable fixed income. The ESG fixed income market has seen impressive growth since its establishment more than a decade ago. But more recently, performance has been lacking. Despite this, many believe the market will see a resurgence. And some even say fixed income is the most mature and developed segment of the sustainable finance universe and is offering large potential for diversification. We speak to Chris Atkinson, fixed income portfolio manager at Fidelity International, Stuart Chilvers, fixed income fund manager at Rathbones, and Minesh Patel, a chartered financial planner and director of EA Financial Solutions, about how they navigate the current market and where the future opportunities lie. As a reminder, this podcast qualifies for CPD. After listening to this podcast, you'll be able to communicate popular ESG fixed income strategies, explain how bond managers are responding to market turbulence, and highlight how ESG bonds can act as a diversification tool. Hi all, thanks for being here today. Now, before we talk about recent bond performance, I'd like to just talk a little bit about what types of ESG bonds there are for people to invest in. What strategies are popular at the moment? What do you like investing in, Chris?
Well, okay, so yeah, there are obviously quite a few ESG labeled securities. So we have essentially what is called the use of proceeds bonds. So these are bonds where they have a defined use of the capital, right? So that typically is a the most common one is a green labeled security, so green use of proceeds bonds. But you can also have sustainability bonds, blue bonds, social bonds, where there is a sort of tightly controlled process around the allocation of those proceeds and then the monitoring and the reporting of those proceeds going forward. So that is the sort of most common type of ESG fixed income security that's in the market today. Recently, we've had this sort of innovation, which is called sustainability-linked bonds or sustainability-linked notes. These are securities where the instruments have their coupon is tied to the achievement of certain goals and objectives, corporate objectives of the company. So, for example, it might be decarbonization. A company might commit to reduce its carbon emissions by a certain amount. If it fails to meet that objective, then the coupon steps up. There is effectively a financial penalty. So these became a little bit more popular in the last couple of years, but received a little bit of pushback in terms of the quality around that sort of process. And so the issuance this year has sort of fallen away as a percentage of the overall ESG bond market. So in terms of the sort of approach and the strategies that we follow, I mean, we do look at all of these labeled securities. We think there's varying degrees of quality, but we're also very focused on overall corporate ESG and sustainability transition. And therefore, we're not confined purely to ESG labeled securities. We do our own homework, if you like, and try to identify companies that are having a positive impact, but might not necessarily be issuing a so-called ESG labeled bond. So that is sort of a very quick canter through the market. I think the issuance trends have continued to grow over the last few years, but I think we shouldn't expect ESG labeled bonds to be immune from broader market trends. So, for example, when the market is shut to general fixed income securities, you shouldn't expect ESG to defy that overall market trajectory. So, we've seen general issuance trends move up and down over the last couple of years in line with the broader market.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Stuart, what do you like to invest in when it comes to sustainable fixed income?
Yeah, so we're similar to Chris in the sense that we will look at ESG labelled issuance, and we will consider the use of proceeds, the ring fence bonds separately, potentially from their issuer. So if the issuer does not pass our screening process, so the Rathbone Ethical Bond Fund has a negative and positive screening process, use of proceeds can be considered differently if we have a positive view on the sort of financing framework as part of that. On the other hand, sustainability linked, we won't look at those any differently from the overall issuer. because your proceeds aren't ring-fenced in any way. In fact, for us, when we look at those issuers who are using that type of debt, often they're from issuers who are actually would fall foul of our negative screening process, so we would not invest in this. Mm-hmm. But as Chris mentioned, we will look at the whole corporate bond universe, and we will use Green Bank, who are ethical, sustainable, and impact investment unit. We use a research team within there, so they are completely separate from our investment team. So we will look for an idea, we will then send it to that team. They will decide whether it passes the ethical screening process. They have a hard veto, so we quite like that from a governance approach. It completely separates out any conflict of interest from our behalf, because you have an independent body, albeit within Rathbones, but independent investment team, who just say whether it passes that criteria or not, and then monitor on an ongoing basis.
Mm. And what's your view on government bonds? Can they ever be ethical? I know some fund managers think they are. Others say it's not possible.
Yeah, so I think it's quite a personal question, in terms of I don't think I can be the arbiter for everyone as to whether government debt is ethical or not. Clearly, some of their spending has very positive consequences, and some of it more negative. For us, as part of our screening criteria, it does not pass our screening criteria because of defence spending, for instance. It's the reason why Bryn Jones, my boss, the lead fund manager of the Ethical Bond Fund, has been lobbying for green gilts for much of the past decade, until they're issued in 2021, so we could partake in government bond debt. For us, it doesn't pass our screening criteria because of the negative screening we have in place.
Mm-hmm. Is that the same for Fidelity?
Not quite. We have a similar approach, and I would agree. It's a very personal decision around whether or not you would qualify a government bond as ethical. Given that you could be funding anything from defence all the way through to healthcare to social care. However, for me personally, I view government and government issuance as effectively where government is forced to step into where the market wouldn't otherwise provide that particular service, right? So it is there to provide, strong institutions. It's there to provide healthcare. It's there to provide the sorts of services that you just wouldn't get provided for by the market. So if you take a government issuance through the sort of lens of addressing market failures, then essentially it should be ethical. Now, of course, as with any corporate, you can have good management and bad management. And there are certainly some governments who, perhaps are not living up to the billing of addressing market failures and providing an environment for their population that is more positive and more sustainable. For example, governments who, renege on their decarbonisation commitments, that sort of thing, for example, right? So for us, the way that we approach that is to say, well, each of these governments needs an assessment, right? Needs an ESG assessment that says, are you moving in the right direction? Are there any major flags that are tripped that you would not consider to be appropriate for a sustainable or an ESG fund? But inherently, they should be ethical, broadly defined.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, let's bring in the advisor perspective, Vinesh. How do you use sustainable bonds, and how do you respond to how the managers view the space?
Well, in terms of where we use ESG bonds, they're a portfolio diversifier. Unusually, since the financial crisis, bonds became a growth asset, and traditionally that's not the space they occupy. They're an income producer and a bond diversifier. In terms of what the managers have said, I quite like the idea of sustainability linked bonds, and that could be a route to expansion of ESG integration, because although they're not strictly purpose led, i.e. a green bond or a social bond, they could reward better behaviour. So in one of your, in the preparation, you talked about can oil companies, for example, to reward better behaviour as opposed to where they are now. And that could actually improve the universe. and for penalties for debt issuance if they don't meet targets and goals. It's a very small part of the market, as Chris has said so far, but I see great applications in that particular. I mean, the biggest area is obviously green bonds at the moment, but in terms of what Chris said, I think, and what Stuart said, social bonds, I think, have a great application because there are deficiencies in government allocation resources. There's great poverty in the UK and the US, massive. So where does, you know, there is gaps in funding that require a specific purpose, lack of education in cities, etc. So, you know, you've got to take specific targets and objectives to very real needs in society. And I think social bonds is a great place, for example, in the US, which is federal rather than central government.
Mm-hmm.
You've got municipal bonds. You know, maybe that's a routine for the expansion of, you know, real specific applications which have very real outcomes.
Mm-hmm. And I suppose in that respect, it almost allows you to invest more directly, doesn't it, as a bond investor than it would do as an equity, perhaps. Now, nevertheless, it's been a tough time the last 18 months or so for bonds and on their performance. How have you responded to that, Chris?
So I think this is obviously an unusual time in fixed income markets, given that we've just come off the back of more than a decade of, you know, what is, you know, a monetary policy experiment. And as we've come out of COVID and the exceptional fiscal and monetary response that came about from that, combined with the narrowing of supply chains, I suppose we all had a collective failure of imagination in how that would feed through to inflation. And I include myself in that, and central bankers, economists, you know, I think it's just, you know, I think we should have possibly done a better job anticipating the impact that would have. So how do we address that now as fixed income investors? Well, I think we've had the reset. We've had the reset in rates. Clearly, we're having a debate in the market at the moment around, you know, how much longer are rates going to remain higher? Is there any further hikes to come through? But I think we can probably all agree that we're more or less close to the inflection point. Maybe, you know, we'll be a few months out here or there, but we're not far away. And so the approach that we've been taking, certainly over the course of this year, is to take very measured positions, try and be nimble, try and be not get wedded to any particular position, recognize the fact that data prints are proving volatile. They're being, even when you think you've got the data print right, the market reaction is often not as you would necessarily expect it to be. And clearly geopolitical risk, as we've seen over the last few days, has been increasing. So I think this is not an environment to be sticking your neck out and taking, you know, large oversized positions, particularly in duration. And the way that we approach it from a credit perspective is that, you know, we've long had a philosophy of sort of bottom-up fundamental credit homework that you need to do to ensure that your downside is covered. We take a relatively cautious approach to our credit selection, and we're pretty diversified. The reason for that is because, obviously, as we move forward in this pretty much unprecedented hiking cycle that we've experienced starts to feed through, then we expect a slowdown. We expect the implications to become evident in the market, increasing dispersion, increasing default rates. And we want to make sure that, you know, the credits that we're holding aren't going to be those that we're forced to take impairments on. So mm-hmm. I think that for us is the sort of, a gradual approach to accumulating alpha rather than try and swing the bat and potentially miss.
Mm-hmm. And is Fidelity's thinking in the sustainable fixed income space broadly similar to the normal conventional fixed income space in that respect?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it is. It's the same approach, right? So, you know, the way that we approach the assignment of VSG ratings, our proprietary ratings, it's a combination of our internal sustainability team and also the credit and the equity analysts. And the reason that we incorporate the credit and the equity analysts is because, you know, we have large SI team, sustainable investment team, but they're never going to be as large as our credit and equity team. And they are the ones that know and understand the credits and the sectors better than anybody else. So we feel that their expertise is absolutely invaluable in feeding into those ESG ratings. So when we take the same approach to portfolio construction, but of course we then apply an extra layer of rigor and exclusions, negative and positive, around the securities and the sectors that would be included in those portfolios. But still, absolutely critical for any fixed income portfolio is diversification. Right? Mm-hmm. We have to recognize that we are an asymmetric asset class, and that if we are overexposed to any particular sector or region or country, the potential there is for that we will get, you know, we will experience a lot of pain. So, mm-hmm. you know, for example, and maybe we will come back to this later. You know, we had last year, yeah, obviously the rate shock, and that fed through to a handful of sectors. You know, real estate most notably. And real estate was a big sector in the green bond market. So were banks. That was obviously also impacted quite negatively. And then we had the commodity price volatility in Europe, and that impacted the utilities. So the three biggest corporate sectors within the green bond universe were all negatively impacted all in the space of 1 year. So that's why it's absolutely critical that you have this diversified approach, mm-hmm. you know, and you recognize that the transition, whatever that looks like, has to be a pan across the whole economy, not just certain segments.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do want to come back to diversification in a minute. But for now, Stuart, can you just tell us how you've responded to the market volatility?
Yeah, sure. So I think coming into 2022, we did not have the foresight like anyone else that inflation was going to be much, much stickier and more and higher than anyone else expected. But we did come in with a shorter duration than most. Certainly, if you compared to like a Sterling IG corporate index, which, given the sector we sit in, seems reasonable, we came in with significantly lower duration. And the reason for that was we just felt we weren't being particularly paid for the duration risk at that point. We've been quite slow to add that back, thinking all the way back to sort of February Monetary Policy Committee, UK 10-year gilt, I think, touched near 3%, and we were struggling to understand why at that point we felt there was still a decent way to go in terms of rate rise. We didn't feel we were at the end of that journey. Recently, we've been starting to build that duration up, mainly through long-dated green gilts, actually, so particularly the 30-year green gilt. So we're now deploying somewhat of a barbell, so where you have inverted curves as well, using short-end corporate paper where you're still getting quite attractive yields, alongside a 30-year green gilt position and some in a 10-year green gilt position to add some of that duration to the portfolio. We've gone through a number of time reviews, in particular BBB minus names and any names which you think could suffer in a more challenging economic outlook, and look to exit those from the portfolio. And recently, sort of back end of last month, we were looking at particularly long-dated corporate paper where we felt spreads were starting to get back towards 2021 levels in terms of the tights, and we just felt that didn't reflect what we think will pan out in terms of the economic outlook.
Mm-hmm. And where do you see kind of the future opportunities in sustainable fixed income?
I think they're going to be incredibly broad. I think when you look at any of the number of estimates about the amount of investment needed for the world to reach its net zero targets, they are gigantic, and clearly a significant portion of that will need to be funded from debt markets, and that will give the opportunity for more sustainable issuance, and really importantly, really continue the start of the broadening out we've seen in terms of sectoral issuance. I think we may see more innovation in that space. Things like blue bonds are still, you know,
What is a blue bond?
So it's where it's again a use of proceeds bond, but it's in terms of looking after marine ecosystems, so looking after the oceans. But I wouldn't expect that to become as significant as green bonds, for instance. I'm just not sure it's realistic in terms of the scale. You have some of these sort of debt for nature swaps, which we've seen recently. I think depending how they pan out, again, you could see a bit of growth in that area, but I still don't expect it to be one of these big, large pillars like green, social, sustainability. Sustainability linked, I think we'll see. I think we'll see how that evolves. There was that huge pickup in issuance. You said it's now come back slightly. I think it'll be interesting to see how that evolves in terms of how challenging the targets are associated with it, how the level of step up in coupons. It will be interesting to see how that asset class evolves.
Mm-hmm. What about you, Chris? Where do you see the future opportunities?
Well, like Stuart, I think the funding needs are so significant there has to be opportunity within that. So we know, we've seen the estimates around what we need to raise for climate change, to address climate change, biodiversity. I think we're somewhere in the region of, 700 billion to a trillion short a year of what we need to be raising. So that should open up a lot of opportunities. Now, I think for us, the real opportunity is within transition. And this is the very tricky area of the market to crack, right? Because we all know, in terms of sustainability, let's stay within climate change, because that's the easiest one, I think the one we're all most familiar with, right? We're not in the end state. We're not in the position that we need to do. We're not net zero. We haven't achieved 1.5 degrees. So effectively, that means that pretty much every corporate, every country is in a state of transition. And yet, there are some sectors and some countries which struggle to raise capital in the labelled bond market because, and come back to the point that you were making about the sustainability linked bonds, the aspiration around the targets. But I think we need to find a way to bridge that gap, because there are sectors that are absolutely critical for decarbonisation. So think about metals and mineral space, where those materials are required within new technologies, and yet the sort of production increment that we need is somewhere between, I think I was listening to a research piece this morning, somewhere between 8 times for the sort of best supply commodities, up to 400 times increment in terms of production. So we've got to find a way of addressing this need. So that, I think, for me, is where the biggest opportunity lies. Because if we can address that funding need, then we can speed up the transition. But we have to find a way of doing that, which is consistent with the challenges that we face as investors with our clients, and saying that we're not greenwashing, right? We are investing in the transition. And likewise with regulation, which is obviously trying to ensure that we're not greenwashing and that what we're selling is what it says it is. But we have to find a way of addressing that transition. And if we don't address that transition, then we may as well give up on our mm-hmm. on our climate aspirations.
Mm-hmm. And what does it all mean for the advisor, Minesh? How have you responded to the drop in bond prices, sustainable bond prices, and market volatility? And where do you go from here?
Well, from an advice perspective, my job has become defending portfolios in the longer term, because we all talk about the longer term, but the client's perspective on what they view as longer term and the professional's view on what longer term are at odds. That's my reading of the last 2 years, 18 months, or sorry, 18 months. And also the period of recovery for assets is not aligned. So on average, statistically, I think 16 months for a recovery in assets when there's a market decline. But really, an investor views it as like a few months, 2-3 months. So I started to sort of challenge my own thinking to say, well, there has been academic theory which suggests, well, why don't we just go 100% equities and just park the rest in cash? I mean, there's a challenge now. I'm not saying I'll pursue that challenge. There's a challenge to say, well, why bonds? Why bonds? Because the bond diversifier last 2 years has not worked. Yeah, it's not worked. And that's a challenging conversation for an advisor to have, because your everything you've been taught professionally is being challenged. Mm-hmm. Now, but the rational part of me then says, well, you've got to look at very unusual, challenging conditions, an elevated inflation environment, which nobody saw coming. I think we'd all agree central banks saw that as transitory, and everyone viewed it as transitory. And we had the Russia-Ukraine war, which created even worse supply-side issues. So the whole legitimacy of the bonds and the role within portfolios, and that includes ESG, is now under challenge a bit more, particularly from the end user. Yeah, the end user is challenging what the role of bonds are. I would still argue, and this is my narrative to clients, that you're paying for the coupon, a steady income, which when reinvested at the long-term growth, it's an income play as much as rather than a capital growth play. But yes, it is very challenging when 60-40, 50-50, 40-60, whatever the norms have been, have underperformed against a 100% equity portfolio. Obviously, different degrees of X, small caps have been very, very challenged, largely due to yields increasing on bonds, again, because that's their pricing. So I believe from managers, I think there needs to be a reinforcement of why buy bonds in the first place. I mean, sort of going back to basics. I mean, that sounds rather fundamental, but the client is fundamental. The client is very short term in their thinking as opposed to long term. But our perspective and our narrative has to widen that view. Yeah. I do think there's an opportunity now in bonds because pricing has come off such a lot. Yeah. There is an opportunity certainly for ESG bonds, which have a longer lens, and the UK really is at the heart of quite strong issuance on gilts or green gilts. So I think going back to the fundamental argument, what do bonds need really do within the portfolio? That needs to, and where can ESG bonds enhance that relationship?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, let's put that question to the two managers to finish off.
So where can ESG bonds enhance the relationship between between our end investors and
how do they meant to act as a diversifier in a portfolio?
So I mean, I think we've had exactly the same comments from some of the advisors that we speak to. This is supposed to be the defensive part of the portfolio, and it's down 15%, 18%, 20% over the last 12 months. What gives? Which is a perfectly fair comment. And this is why I came back to earlier on about the sort of unusual period that we're moving through at the moment. And the analogy that I use is back in the sort of 90s, we had a sort of big Fed move, middle of the 90s, which then sort of rippled through the markets over a period of a number of years. And there were various blow-ups, which I'm sure some of your listeners can recall. We had with LTCM, we had the Asia crisis, we had Latin American crisis, we had Russian crisis. That's how I see this playing through now, right? So we've had the big rate shock, right? That's we're pretty much at the end of that, right? And obviously, as a fixed income investor, the transmission is basically one for one, right? Because the discounted cash flows are, it's just the impact comes through straight away. In equities and other parts of the fixed income universe, the sort of higher yielding, lower quality parts of the fixed income universe, that transmission is not always one for one, right? So, but it, the discount rate has still gone up, right? And if you've got a stream of equity dividends or a stream of cash flows coming from an equity investment, the discount rate is still higher. So the fact that equities have defied gravity to a certain extent, I would say they defy gravity because I'm a fixed income investor, but the fact that they defy gravity to me is something that investors should be cautious about, not optimistic. I think that now is not the right time to be saying, well, bonds have underperformed over the last 18 months, therefore we should be divesting of our bonds and piling into equities, because I think you'd just be going out of the frying pan into the fire. Now, the question is around, how does ESG-labeled bonds or how does ESG fit into that? Well, for me, it's a question of governance, right? So a good ESG investment is a company that has good governance. It's good governance around, obviously, the defensive minority interests and so on and so forth, but it's also thinking about future risks. It's thinking about the risks inherent in the business from climate change, about the risk inherent from social changes, from geopolitical changes, from cybersecurity, so on and so forth. So a management team or a government that is not thinking about those long-term risks is not thinking about the resilience of its business, of its country. Right? So investing in strong ESG credits is really just future-proofing your investment. And obviously, as fixed income investors, that's what we care about. We care about the downside. We care about the impairment of our capital. Right, and if companies aren't thinking about that, they're not thinking in that way, and they're just thinking about the short term, this quarter to the next quarter, then you know that for us is a big warning flag around the viability of their business over the long term. So that's how I see ESG fitting in with fixed income and providing a greater degree of resilience to those cash flows and to that security going forward.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Stuart, final word on ESG bond as a diversifier.
Yeah, I mean, I don't disagree with anything Chris said, so I won't sort of recover any of that. I guess two other points, which I think are quite interesting, but very early stage at this point, is there's some evidence that labelled issuance outperforms standard issuance during times of severe stress, albeit it's over a very limited time frame. So I think we need to be very careful using, you know, assuming that's the case, but there is limited evidence of that through the stresses where we've had them in existence. So that could potentially be a positive side of it. And then sort of looking forward, looking at the Bank of England greening their corporate bond purchase scheme, obviously that's now been entirely unwound, but thinking about if you get to a stage where it doesn't feel like we're sort of in that world at the moment, but if you could see corporate bonds being purchased again by the Bank of England, well, there is now the greening criteria they've put around that. There are certain exclusionary criteria within it, and then within sectors there'll be tilts in terms of how many bonds are purchased from a certain issuer depending how they're scoring on their climate system. So in that scenario, well, better performing issuers on those metrics theoretically will see more of their bonds purchased. So if you sort of follow the theory through, that should mean they should suffer less volatility, right? So that could be a benefit, but clearly we've not seen that come into practice yet. It's sort of quite a recent development. But I think those two things could be potentially beneficial for ESG bonds as a diversifier over and above sort of the standard bond piece.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Great. Well, thank you very much to our guests for joining us today and giving us your insights. It was a really fascinating discussion. And thank you for listening. Please remember to bank your CPD after answering the 6 questions in the article below. After listening to this podcast, you're able to communicate popular ESG fixed income strategies, explain how bond managers are responding to market turbulence, and highlight how ESG bonds can act as a diversification tool. Thank you.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Here at Bellingcat, we get to the bottom of things. From a global crisis to an underreported event, we find the facts using publicly available tools and resources, uncovering what is hidden on and below the surface. We connect the dots using social media posts, satellite images, and public records, and empower others to do the same by sharing how we do it. The ability to do so is only made possible by our readers, supporters, and community members. Care to join us? Learn how at bellingcat.com.